Hi, and this is the Physics High Podcast. A quick quiz. Do you A, want to be inspired by science communicators? B, want to learn all about science education? C, want guidance on your scientific journey? Well, how about D, all of the above? Now, good science communication is a coin that has two sides. On the one side is to communicate science, to take the complex topics and present it in a way that the general audience can understand and appreciate. But the other side of the coin is to educate, to help students of science understand the complex, but even more importantly, to teach them how to think critically, scientifically, so they can apply those skills to their fields of study. Now, my guest today does that and more. Kelly Foyle is the outreach scientist at the Perimeter Institute, a physics research facility based in Canada, where she concentrates on developing resources to equip teachers in their science classrooms. Welcome, Kelly.
Welcome. Thanks.
Now, you are the outreach scientist at the Perimeter Institute. Some of my listeners are already familiar with the Perimeter Institute, having interviewed Dave Fish a few months ago. Can you tell us a little bit more, just in case some people haven't heard anything about the Perimeter Institute, what the Perimeter Institute is, and particularly what your role is there?
Right. So Perimeter is a theoretical physics institute, and we're located in Waterloo in Canada. So that's just outside of Toronto. And there's about 150 researchers that, well, they're not physically there at the moment because of the pandemic, but usually are. And we sort of span the whole range of physics in terms of theoretical physics, from the physics of the very small, looking at the atom, quantum mechanics, particle physics, all the way up to, you know, the big scale, cosmology, answering those kinds of questions, and also sort of the physics in between, so like tabletop physics, like condensed matter. In that case, you're pushing things to the extremes in temperature, those kinds of things. And then in addition to that, throughout the year, a lot of scientists call Perimeter their second home. So there's always, in good times, we have researchers that are coming to stay for a few weeks or a few months, spend some time, collaborate with the other researchers. A few of the physicists are also involved in some of the more experimental sides of physics, like at CERN, at the LHC, or those kinds of things. And so they dabble in a bit of that. Others have a more of a focus in mathematics, so it's a little bit of a blend of physics and mathematics. So there's kind of like the two ends of the spectrum, from the very heavy mathematics side of theory all the way to some physicists that are doing theoretical physics at PI, but maybe doing some experimental work at other institutions. And then beyond the people that are doing the research in the building, we also have a large outreach mandate. So we have a team of seven people that work to do outreach and education in a variety of different ways. So some of that's with the general public, and we have a public lecture series and those kinds of things. But our main focus is really on high school teachers, and we do some work with elementary school teachers as well, developing resources. We bring in teachers like Dave Fish, who you mentioned, and teachers like that come in for a year or two, work with people at PI to develop resources to use in the classroom for all of the sciences. Like, we have a strong affinity for physics. We like physics, but we do other things too. We have resources on climate change, elementary school resources as well. And then we do a lot of PD with teachers too. And so that's where my main focus is doing, working on those resources, working with teachers, and then I do some student programming as well. We have a summer camp for students in the summer that I run, and it's for students that are really keen about physics, see themselves as aspiring theoretical physicists, and we sort of do this two-week awesome, amazing experience and get them together from all around the world.
The Perimeter Institute resources website is replete with lots of excellent resources that you have had a hand in producing. Take us a little bit through as to the process of, okay, we want to go through this concept and we want to produce a resource that really enhances the education of that concept. What's the process involved?
So usually we have, at the moment, on the current resources that we're working on, we have two people that have a background in physics. So there's myself and then somebody else that has a background in quantum physics. And the fact that we have a background in that really doesn't matter. In a lot of ways, when you become too specialized, it's actually difficult to be able to take the things that you're thinking about and cast them out of your mind. So in some ways, it's easier to work on topics that are a little bit further away from you, because you can still experience a little bit what it would be like to be someone learning it for the first time. And then we have two teachers that work with us. And so we all sit down together. We decide on what kind of a resource we're going to do. You know, is it going to be something for more senior students? And I should say that the resource is targeted to teachers. But of course, that's because we hope, you know, one teacher reaches many, many students. And so it's written to the teacher, but the hope is to get that out to students. And so we all, you know, we brainstorm different ideas. This is the fun part. We test out lots of stuff, lots of ideas we come up with. We test them. We try for hands-on activities. They don't work. We get rid of them. And then somewhere in all of that, we kind of settle out at around maybe 6 activities that are going to be part of a single resource. So those activities might last one class, depending on how long your class is, somewhere between an hour to an hour and a half in length, if one were to do that in the class. And then we test it. So we go into schools, we take it to teachers and ask them to test it in their own classroom. And then it comes back all with lots of comments, lots of things to change. And then we rework it from there. So it takes about a whole year to start to get a resource from the time we start talking about it, by the time we've tested all the ideas, rewritten everything, and then taken it to design and all of that. And then many of the resources also come with a high quality professionally made video, so that's also an added feature that comes along with them that takes some time to make.
Hopefully the teachers watching, they will recognize that the resources aren't something that was made on the fly. There's a lot of work that goes into these resources. What's your favorite resource that you've had a hand in?
Well, I did a resource last year about black holes, which is a topic, since my own background is astrophysics, was really, really exciting. I loved that one a lot. But I also really liked the one that we did on climate change. And that's for the opposite reason, because I didn't know very much about that when I started, and I just learned so much. I mean, I knew, you know, I knew what climate change was and all of that, but I didn't really have any time in my, you know, as a student, I never had that as a topic when I was in high school, climate change unit, which is now part of the curriculum in many places. And so for me, it was a great time to just learn a lot. And so I had a lot of fun doing that one as well, because there I was, you know, just learning. I had this basically a year to get to learn so much. And so that was really neat. And we got to work with, you know, climate scientists and ask them questions. And so it was just a great year of learning all kinds of amazing stuff. So those two really stand out. The black holes, mostly because it was a topic that I get very excited about. It's something that I, you know a lot about and I like thinking about. But then the other one is because I don't know very much about it. So the two, you know, the two bookends, I guess.
Which is actually a really important theme, because you're a science communicator, and one of the things about science communication is that we're not experts at everything. And so we're the science experts, but at the same time, we are constantly relearning. And that's part of the joy about being in this profession of science. There's never an end. There's always something new to learn, whether it's something new in your own field or something new in a completely different field.
Yeah, I mean, I think teachers, part of the reason they become teachers is because they love learning. I think scientists the same. That's just something that, you know, just constantly wanting to find out something new, pushing to find, you know, and even topics, you know, that you think, okay, this is known in the world, like there is people that know this, so I'm not maybe discovering something new, but, you know, it takes a long time and a lot of repetition to really digest a concept. And even, you know, when we did the black holes resource, there was, you know, I had gone through grad school doing general relativity and all of this stuff, and then when it came down to like, okay, I've got to be able to explain this without all of this mathematics, you know, I was still learning. I was still trying to get my head around this concept, even after all of this time, trying to, you know, actually, do I really understand that? Or have I just been, you know, using equations, and the equations I just sort of trusted, but I actually didn't really deeply understand it. So it takes a long time, but it's such rewarding effort to have that moment where it's like, wow, I get this now.
Now, in a previous life, you referred to your postdoctoral research in astrophysics. You were involved with spectroscopic and photometric analysis from the Herschel Space Observatory. Can you tell us a little bit what that involved? If someone said, what is photometric and what is spectroscopic observations, what did you do?
Yeah, so, I mean, that was a pretty neat part of my postdoc. I was actually more of a theory person in my PhD, and I had done a lot of computer simulations. And then as I was doing that, I was like, wow, you know, I love all these simulations, but, you know, what is, like, real galaxies like, right? Like, are you cooking up the real thing? And so I started to interact with a lot of observational people, and I was like talking to them a lot and trying to compare the simulations. And then there was this opportunity to maybe do this postdoc where I'd be working with real data. And I had never really had an interest in taking my own data, because you have to worry about things like the weather, you have to worry about all kinds of other stuff. And so I'd always sort of stayed away. But, you know, with Herschel, the telescopes in space, you don't need to worry about a lot of stuff. It's going up there. And so it sort of felt like this was my opportunity. And so with Herschel, it studies far infrared light. So it's really a great place to look for there's a lot of dust, basically. It sounds like that means it's a messy place, but it's a lot of cosmic dust that are in galaxies. And it blocks our view for a lot of things, including star formation. And so with Herschel, when you look at this far infrared light, it's almost like looking through the dust. The dust absorbs the radiation from the stars and re-radiates it, just like that hot pavement when you're outside and the sun is heating up the pavement. We get to get that information from the stars as it's like sort of basically heated through the dust. And so the photometric is just actually just taking pictures of the light, and the spectroscopy is breaking up that light and being able to look for the signatures, molecular signatures of different things that are in this interstellar medium. So what's in a galaxy? What are the ingredients? Someone once asked me, they were like, oh, what does a galaxy taste like? What does the interstellar medium taste like? There's all this stuff there. When you look at the kind of dusty ingredients, I don't think it would taste very good. It would be a bit of a gritty, kind of a taste. And you know, you look at the spectroscopy to be able to see, different molecules that are in this environment.
You clearly have a way with words. I love your analogy of what does a galaxy taste like, because it's not something that you normally associate with. You clearly love your science. Clearly your science journey started at an early age. Tell us a little bit about how you got interested in science. My understanding, a lesson on talk even had a part to play.
A lesson on what?
Talk.
Talk?
T-O-R-Q-U-E.
Oh, on torque. Oh, I heard talk. Sorry, it's the Australian. What?
That's funny. I'll say it again. My understanding is that a lesson on torque had a part to play in it.
Yeah, so when I was in high school, I had a very amazing physics teacher who had a lot of energy. And I remember, you know, lots of great moments in that class. But one of them was our class on torque, which is like kind of a mundane topic. We think, you know, now, like, you know, you think of all the physics I've learned, but it just made all kinds of things in my everyday world sort of click. I was like, oh, this is why this really happens. You know, this is why the handle on the door is here and it's not somewhere else in the door. And, you kind of knew this stuff in a way. People talk, you know, when you're doing work outside with a shovel about mechanical advantage and different stuff like that. But it was, you know, the first time that I really had this like really excitement about this, something that I had learned. It wasn't the first time. There was lots of stuff that I enjoyed, I should say. But, you know, it was incremental along the way. I love science and I love learning, and there was lots of stuff that I liked. Like, I liked history and there was lots of things that were exciting to learn. But it also happened to be that I was good at it. So that helped, right? Like, I was, you know, doing well in physics, and that sort of carried me forward too. And so it was, you know, I wouldn't say it came easy. There's certainly lots of moments that it was very difficult in university, that I found it hard, but it was always exciting. There was so much in physics, you know, you could be talking about that, and then the next day there you're learning about special relativity, and then the next day you're learning about astrophysics, and it was always very exciting.
So what made you want to go into astrophysics?
Well, I actually had a hobby from as a young child. I liked looking at the constellations and learning the stars and all of that. And I had been doing that for a long time. And then I kind of realized when I was in high school that actually this astronomy thing was actually part of physics. And I was like, oh, I didn't even know that. And I was like, well, I'm going to do physics. You know, when I went to university in my first year of university, I was like, okay, I'm going to take this astrophysics course, like, who knows, right? And then it just sort of snowballed from there. I didn't know exactly what area in physics I was going to do, but from that one course, I took another extra course in astrophysics, and then I ended up doing research RA in the summer months with astrophysicists, and it just kind of carried on from that.
Yeah, obviously, as you mentioned, you did a PhD, postdoc, and so forth, and you've actually published a number of peer-reviewed papers in astrophysics. But then in 2014, my understanding is you decided to move to Perimeter. What precipitated that?
Well, I'd been doing the education and outreach thing for a while, always on the side. So I had, at Mac, there was a small planetarium, and I had done work in that. When I was doing my PhD, even though I was doing my PhD in Germany, I tried to learn German enough that I was still able to, you know, interact with school kids and do this kind of thing as best I could. There it was a little bit less because of the language. It was always something that was present. And then I kind of came to, there was also a point in the kind of your course of going through research where you usually in the field you have to do more than one postdoc. Usually you do, you know, at least two postdocs now is common. Some people even do three. And I also had this, didn't really feel a strong desire to move again, because I had done like live in Germany, then moved, you know, I'm originally from Montreal, then I was living in Hamilton, and you know, my partner had a tenure track job here in Ontario, and I was like, oh, you know, the thought of moving again, doing this all again, just felt not that exciting to me anymore. I didn't feel excited about it. And so I started to look at other options that would mean that I wouldn't, you know, some of that I thought about maybe becoming a lecturer at a university and doing that because I felt like I was good at teaching. But then this, I saw that this opportunity was available at Perimeter and I applied for it and I was lucky enough to get it. And I've been very, very happy ever since.
So would it be correct to saying that if you were asked what's your job, you'd say you're a science communicator?
Yeah, I think that's a fairly good, I mean, I think it's maybe, I think I'd probably want to get the word educator in there, maybe science educator. And the reason I say that is that I feel sometimes, at least here in Canada, that word science communicator means you're a translator for scientists. Like you take their work and you make it in layman terms so other people can understand it. And that's like one part of what I think I do, but I think it's a little bit, maybe a little bit more than that or a little bit different than that. Like we spend more of our time thinking about how to get people to think scientifically, like how to get students to think that way, as opposed to simply just, you know, giving them like a soundbite to be able to digest a science idea. Mm-hmm. That, you know, that's part of it, but it's only like maybe one part of it.
Mm-hmm. You obviously see science communication as a two-sided coin. There's a part of the, as you mentioned, the digesting of very complex, sometimes scientific concepts to the general public, but then also to educate, particularly students, to think critically, to think scientifically. So why do you think that's important?
Well, it's important in many different ways. You know, there's a lot of information that is quite technical that happens in our world now, like even with the pandemic, from understanding risk to understanding, you know, statistics to understanding, you know, exponential growth. All of these concepts have sort of appeared in the news media. And it's not so much that you want somebody to be able to understand those specific terms, but being able to think about the information that they're hearing, being able to put it in a in the place in their mind, and having that skill of being able to listen and, you know, almost be do a little bit of detective work. In some ways, that's one aspect of what science is a little bit of a detective work, trying to piece together what all of this is about. And I think that's one part of the skill for people to learn at a younger age that can help them, whether they go into science or not. These kinds of, you know, how we think about a problem, how do we tackle a problem, you learn that in physics and you learn that in science, but it actually is very applicable in all sorts of other areas in your life. And so I think that is important. And then I also feel like one of the things that I do is I work with people, or I do quite a lot with the student focus for me, are students who are really hungry for that physics, but can rarely find something more than just popular media on that topic. They want to know more, they want to understand it, and then, you know, the next level up is, you know, a third year undergraduate course textbook or a graduate school textbook. And a lot of those things that they want to understand, they actually can, and you can do it with high school mathematics. And you just don't see that very often. It's usually either one way or the other. It's either this really like deep dive where you need to know tensor calculus, or you're going to get like a one paragraph explanation in Scientific American, and there's not very much in between. So that's another piece that I enjoy doing, is kind of taking students who kind of really want to go there, and, you know, they don't have necessarily tensor calculus yet, but they'd like to get close to those ideas. I find that also quite a lot of fun and part of what I do. And I think that helps those really keen students see that physics is for them, and that they are going to get to those really interesting places. And they're not like, oh, physics, it's just like rolling balls down ramps. Like, when do we get to the good stuff?
What are the challenges, do you think, in terms of science communication that we have?
Well, there's so many, right? You know, there's so many challenges, because you, depending on what you're doing, on who your audience is, it's a very different beast, right? When you sit and you talk to the general public, it's very, I find that quite challenging, because your audience, there's so much in that audience. Whereas when you're doing things with students, usually you kind of know who they are. They're at this particular age. They've seen this in the curriculum before. You know they're going to see that in the curriculum afterward. And that's actually a much easier thing to tackle, because you have a better sense of what's going on. And the same thing with teachers. You know where they're at. But when it comes to the general population, there's so many challenges. People come in with all kinds of ideas. Many of these ideas are sadly wrong. And so much of what you have to do is kind of step through kind of unpacking ideas that are incorrect, which is difficult to do, because the older you get, the more you hang on to those ideas. And then people often are afraid of physics in the general public. You say physics and they're like, oh no, I had that horrible high school teacher, so I can't do physics.
You get that glazed look across the eyes when you say you're a physics educator.
Yeah, or they try to ask you about Big Bang Theory or something.
That's right.
Clearly another passion of yours is raising the profile of women in science, and physics in particular. Why is that important to you?
Well, you know, I was a woman going through physics as myself, and there are challenges to it. And I think many of those challenges stop being there when there's more women there. So it's just really a matter of having more people in the room. And so for me, I feel like it's exciting to see more women, you know, even just in the short time, like I'm not that old. I've gone from seeing like being at sometimes places where I was the only woman to now seeing like conferences where there's like a lot of women in physics. Like it's still like low, like at the 20% level, but you know, it's starting to grow, and that kind of energy is really exciting. And I think that people, I think it's sort of widely known that when you have people that other women in the room, or you have other minorities like you, if that's the group, all of those things help to contribute, and it becomes a snowball effect where there's more and more women involved. You know, in actually within physics, astrophysics tends to be the place where you find most women who are in physics. And a lot of that is historical because there was a lot of women that were hired to just do basically be like a human computer to study photographic plates. And then those women ended up contributing to the field. But I'm not a historian of science, but I don't think it's just an accident that we end up having more women in astrophysics than we do in other disciplines. I think that led to you know, women being more acceptable within the field and women seeing other women in the field, and so it continued from there. You know, my own, I had my master's supervisor, he was a man, but it turned out his supervisor had been a woman. And so there was always this odd connection that somehow the people that you were with had, you know, it was rare to kind of find a man who had been had a supervisor as a male and had all of this, then having like lots of women within their group. And so there is this thing, if you can just get a critical mass of people there, then it can grow. And I think that's really the case.
You mentioned the women in the background in astrophysics. Actually, I just published a video on stellar temperature, and in my research, and I actually put this in the video of Annie Cannon, who basically was responsible for analyzing all the photographic plates. So it was the men taking the photos, but it was her and a number of other women who should be more well known, doing all the hard work, and it was her work that led us to the Harvard system of stellar classification. So, you know,
Sure, yeah.
a great example of, again, women contributing to science and often not getting as enough credit as they should. So you're speaking to, let's say, a student, a female student who is considering science and career, considering what we've just discussed, what advice would you give them?
Well, it depends kind of on the stage they're at. You know, if they're looking at the going into grad school versus undergrad, I might have different advice. But if it's, say, the undergrad field, going into an undergraduate, I would say take advantage to do lots of different things. You don't know yet what you want. You might think, you know, when I, you know, I also, when I was in my undergrad, I ended up taking German classes, and then I ended up doing my PhD in Germany, and it was awfully good that I had learned German along the way. Like, doing lots of different things is really, really great. And that, you know, just because you pick science and that's amazing and you should do that, you should also, like, you're a whole person and you should be able to try to take advantage of this undergrad experience to learn. And try to do things that are challenging. Don't kind of fall into the trap. You know, some students think, oh, you know, I'll just take an easy course because I want to get a really good grade. You know, this is the time of your life to have this time to learn. Hopefully you don't have to do other competing things at the same time. If you're lucky to have just this time to learn, challenge yourself. Do something that, you know, when you, as you get older and older, it's going to be harder and harder to tackle calculus, right? Like, you're going to have less and less time for something like that. Now's the time to learn this amazing, powerful tool and take advantage of this time to do that.
So, and now let's say we're speaking to, let's say, a middle high to lower high school student. And again, let's focus on the female students, because often the number of females a number of females in science, around 20%, is actually the same sort of ratio of seeing of students of girls taking particularly the physical sciences in high school. What advice would you give to, let's say, a high school student who's deciding whether she should take a physical science course or not?
For sure. I mean, I think I would say yes, definitely. The younger you are, the more you should try to do these different things, even if they're difficult. And the skills that you're going to learn, even if you don't want to go on to the natural sciences, the skills that you're going to learn, you're going to be able to take with you know, to all kinds of different disciplines. Whether you want to become a chef or you want to become, you know, a historian, there's so much that you're going to get out of that experience that you can take with you. Hopefully you have a good teacher. That would be the one exception if, you have a particularly bad teacher, it can be a negative experience, I suppose. But setting that part aside, this is a great opportunity, and try to, if what intimidates you about that is the fact that you might be one of few women or few women in the room in that class, seek those other people out, seek those other women out that are also doing it, and get together as a group, and you'll find strength in that, I think. Like having those people saying, hey, you're taking that course too. Why are you choosing it? What do you like about it? Maybe we can be elbow buddies or whatever. That can really make the experience a bit easier if that's the concern for taking the course.
And our final bit of advice now, let's talk about the teacher. I'm sure there's none of those bad teachers that we've talked about listening here at all. But if you had an opportunity to say something salient to teachers of how to raise science and encourage their students to consider science as a future career, what advice would you give them?
There's a few things I think I'd say. I think if depending on where that choice happens in your curriculum, the year or so before that, it's really helpful to actually go into those classes and explain to students what it is. Because maybe the boys know what physics is. Oh, that's the cool class where Mr. G does rockets, and that's what I want to do. But maybe the girls actually don't know that there's going to be something in that class that really is exciting. That could be for them, and they may have preconceived ideas about what that course is really like. So, if you can go in and say, hey, this is what's going to happen in physics, this is what's going to happen in chemistry, this is what we're going to be doing in biology, these are the topics you're going to see, that can help, I think, a lot. And then within the classroom environment, too, a lot of the time people ask maybe for volunteers to talk, and you end up having mostly boys. You can find, you put a group, of boys and a girl at an experiment, and they're supposed to work on it, and you see all the boys doing all the measurements and the girls are doing all the writing. Things you can do, tips around that. You can make all girl groups. That makes it an environment where girls are going to have to take measurements and boys are going to have to do writing. You can try to do things where you just ask people, whoever has the longest hair, whoever has the shortest hair is going to answer the question instead of always asking for volunteers. So there's lots of little things you can do to your classroom environment that can change that dynamic where you have, just the most loudest people talking. That are participating. And I think there is a lot of advice out there that you can uncover as a teacher about how to make that classroom environment more, it's better for everyone, because of course there's boys who will do better in that environment as well.
We now come to our final question, Kelly, and this is an opportunity for you to share a little bit about yourself. So I'm going to ask you to share something that you'd love to teach us about, but it doesn't necessarily have to be science. Something that you're really passionate about at the moment that's taking up your time, that you just love to talk about. What would that be, and what would you like to share with us?
Well, I thought about this and I wasn't sure at first. There's all kinds of things that happen right now. It's such a weird time. So you're doing all kinds of stuff. But I have two little kids at home. I have a 2-year-old and a 5-year-old. So especially with the lockdowns, I've been doing a lot of kind of preschool and kindergarten kind of activities with my kids. And I kind of, maybe this is something that is a little bit of a shock to me. But I find it's amazing how so much of like the science activities for the young kids are actually magic tricks, which I never really knew because I don't really spend time. But like, when you're 3 years old, when you do the baking soda and the vinegar, there's actually no science in that at all. I realized like that's all just magic tricks because of course you don't know what acid and bases are. You have no framework to even have an idea. The most you could maybe have students do with that is like have them predict what do you think's going to happen when I put the vinegar in the baking soda. But much of it is just a magic trick, and I feel like, I don't know, I feel like now I want to have this like other life where I kind of do science education for young children, which never would have really occurred to me had I not had children on my own. But I feel like there's lots of cool stuff you can do with kids little kids, where they can actually get a chance to do science. But a lot of this other stuff is really just, to them anyways, magic. Like, you know, when you're really little, there's so many things that are exciting about the world. You don't actually need things to blow up. I think it's more exciting for the parents than it is for the kids in a lot of ways, a lot of these things. It's like, wow, you know, I want this. I perceive science as something where we get to do explosions, and so therefore it must explode in order for it to be science. But I've had this kind of, I've been kind of thinking about that, like, as I'm watching my own kids trying to do science, whatever that is when you're two. But I mean, that's actually everything that you're doing is science, you know, from like rolling little balls and all of this is science. But, you know, the parents call the science the baking soda and the vinegar and the, you know, the mixing the colors and, you know, this kind of thing, which is actually really hard for that age. They would have no hope of ever even understanding what was actually happening there. And then the other thing that I've been really excited about is bird watching. So that's been my latest hobby. I've been doing bird watching off and on for some time, but the pandemic has, like, I've got like 5 bird feeders going now. So I'm North America right now. It's a great time. If I can give your audience a tip, if they live in North America, it's a great time to get out your hummingbird feeder now. Because they're coming through. And so it's an exciting time. And the orioles too are coming our way. So.
I'm not a expert in bird watching, but the stereotypical bird watcher is a balding, middle-aged male standing with plaid pants with a pair of binoculars. You don't look like that at all, but clearly there's more to bird watching than standing in a field with binoculars. Tell us, what do you do when you bird watch?
I like going to play, like, there's the bird feeder thing, so attracting birds to your backyard, that's really fun. But I also like just going out and learning about birds. Like I learned about owl calls, and I've gone out at night, and not recently have I had success, but I've had success calling owls and then having them call back at night, and that's really exciting. I have enjoyed that. Or even having the chance to hear an owl, like I don't end up seeing them most of the time, but you hear the owl and you're like, wow, that's really neat. And then you can identify it by its call. So it's like also like, you know, I think it's a hobby that has many, many different, some people really get into the photography, which is not really for me. But other people, for them, it's just seeing the birds. And for me, I think it's mostly just, it's a way to be out in nature, but then having a task that gives you time to pause and be in nature without just walking rapidly through it. And so that is what I enjoy most about it. But then obviously, like, it's fun to learn about the birds themselves. So there's also that aspect that I like, is that, you know, I'm learning about these things as I'm doing it, but then I also have a reason or something that's driven me out. Okay, I'm going to go here and I'm going to look for a bald eagle today because I've heard that this is a good spot or something like that. So
was there one species of bird that really, like, got you when you got home? You couldn't wait to tell someone that you saw this?
Yeah, the owls for sure, but the other ones are peregrine falcons. So we, like, Waterloo is a kind of a city-ish environment, but peregrine falcons have sort of made the switch from the cliffs out in nature to using tall buildings as their nesting spot. So they're kind of an urban, you know, they've come into this urban environment and made it their own. And the, you know, the peregrine that's born in the city stays in the city. And so it's pretty amazing. These birds go fly very fast. And they catch other birds, and they're the fastest animals on Earth. And if you walk through a city and you look up, the chances, you know, every city probably has a nesting pair of peregrines, and you know, you see these birds swoop down and catch a pigeon. It's pretty wild, like right in the middle of like a downtown environment. It can be pretty thrilling to see, although a little gory. But
so you've seen that happen, obviously.
Yeah. And they fledge, their babies will fledge and fly down, and it's all pretty chaotic. There's like cars and, you know, it's pretty neat.
Pretty cool.
Well, thank you so much, Kelly, for your time. It's been a pleasure talking to you, particularly understanding not only your work, but also your passion for communicating science. And I certainly have a deeper appreciation of bird watchers now, particularly not thinking you have to go necessarily out into the great wonder, nature to do it. You can do it in your own city as well. So
yeah.
So thank you so much for your time, and hopefully have an opportunity to talk in the future again.
Great, thank you. This is fun.
I hope you enjoyed this episode. Please remember to subscribe to get notifications of upcoming interviews. And you can find me on YouTube, Facebook, and Twitter at Physics High. My name is Paul from Physics High. Till next time.